And I picture that there'll be failure, 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 little success. Ooh, follow that a bit. Failure, failure, little success, follow that. Hi, and welcome to episode 82 of Art Juice. This is honest, generous, and humorous conversations to feed your creative soul and get you thinking with me, Louise Fletcher.
And me, Alice Sheridan.
And we are, Alice is broadcasting from somewhere a little bit different today because she's on her holidays and yet still showed up to do this. So thank you very much for doing that. We have a juicy main topic because after last week's episode, and I got all kinds of messages from people worrying about me and offering suggestions and telling me to have a holiday. And it's actually Alice who's having a holiday.
Yeah, we'll talk about holiday. Holiday, in inverted commas.
Yeah, well, we'll get to that. But before, so our main topic follows on from last week, and we're going to talk about breakthroughs. What do they mean and what happens after them? But before we do that, let's do our usual what you've been up to this week. So I gather it's been quite a busy holiday week for you.
Yeah, it has. So we're in Dartmoor. I must admit, it's funny. I'm looking at some people on Instagram who've made the brave escape and gone somewhere either hot and sunny, which my daughter is highly envious of. And she's like, we could just go. People are going. And I'm like, yeah, nah.
No, thank you.
But what made me really envious was a friend of hers has got the tunnel, which she said the train was pretty empty, to Amsterdam, and went to the Van Gogh Museum and said they were the only person in there. I know. So I was kind of like, oh, that kind of thing would be good, wouldn't it?
You normally can't even move.
I know. So a little bit envious of that rather than the hot weather. The hot weather, I just keep reminding myself, no, it's just hot and you get through loads of sun cream and you get covered in mosquito bites. So I'm happy in England. But no Van Gogh Museum here. We're in Dartmoor. So we have sheep and we have moors and we have all the stuff you're used to, really.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's funny, Devon, because you get beaches, but you get moorland and Cornwall as well. And the moorland is very like the northern moorland. So yeah, it's strange. You've got all this bit in the middle between. So for everybody who's not from England, Devon and Cornwall are right at the bottom of the country and I'm up towards the top of the country. And in between, there's all this area that doesn't really have anything like that. There must be a geological reason for this, or a weather reason for this. But whatever it is, it's very much similar. When I look at your videos, it looks like my videos around here.
Yeah. Yeah, actually, I broke a stone wall the other day because I was standing on it and I jumped off one of ours. So we had to rebuild it. It was like, oh, this is heavy. It's kind of like massive stone Jenga jigsaw with rocks that weigh
it up. Actually, one of my favorite things to do is building little stone walls. But one time, about 3 or 4 years ago, Phil went away to London for the weekend with a friend and I accidentally left my handbrake. Got out of the car without putting the handbrake on and it went backwards into our stone wall and demolished the stone wall.
Demolished the stone wall? I think you're going to say demolish the car.
Well, it's quite a tough car, so it didn't, and it was going slowly, so it made a dent in the back of the CRV, but it knocked down the stone wall. So our neighbour built it back up again that weekend, and Phil still doesn't know that I drove a car into it. But our neighbour's son, Morgan, kept every now and then he'll say, you just let cars go into stone walls. And I go, shh. And Phil still doesn't call on what he's talking about.
But they are different, aren't they? Because the stone walls where you are have a row of vertically aligned, is it slates they put on top or just thinner stones? Don't they have a row on the
top stones? Yeah, they're just stones, but they find ones.
And they turn them vertically, so it looks like a kind of letter rack of stones across the top.
Yeah. And it's a real problem with those getting stolen. And there's a farmer near us who's painted them all pink and blue. So it looks awful, but it's to stop people stealing his top stones because they've constantly been taken.
You see, in Devon, they tend not to have that. They just kind of heap them up and grow stuff over it.
Right.
So they're a little bit more...
Higgledy-piggledy.
Higgledy-piggledy.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But they are a lovely part of the landscape.
We like things.
Yeah. There's probably a lot more to stonewalling that I don't know about. It's quite a skill, for sure.
Have you done any drawing while you were away?
Right. So what I have... No, I haven't. I've brought stuff very hurriedly last minute because I was last minute editing things for the membership. So the what to take drawing-wise got very last minute, just shoved in a bag. But actually, sometimes I find that that's good. You just work with what you've got then, what to bring, yeah. Don't you? Paul always rolls his eyes and says, you bring all of this stuff and never use it, which is partly true. And actually, it's interesting, but I decided that I deliberately wasn't going to do anything, nothing, no drawing, no going out for a walk and drawing, no taking my sketchbook with me until I felt I really wanted to, till I felt I really had the urge to do it. And I did yesterday, a week in. So I've had a week of pottering around, sleeping, bit of cooking, you know, nice things, hanging, washing outside, that kind of thing. Getting stuck into a good book, which I know you're going to talk about later. Mm-hmm. It's been a while since I've just thought, you know, that feeling when you think, oh, I've got a book to go back to.
Yeah.
so that. But what I started doing yesterday was I was a bit stuck because I was thinking, I don't feel any urge to go out and draw a thing, what anything looks like. I don't want to draw the landscape. Sorry, landscape. You're very beautiful, but I don't, you know, I'm not feeling it. It's a bit like when I used to be on holiday when I was, you know, 18, 19 and still go with my parents. Mum used to say, go and draw the people at the cat. No, I don't want to. So I was a bit stuck. I was like, well, what do I draw then? Anyway, I have a little sketchbook with me that is tiny. It's an A6 one and it's just random. And I just start pages at random throughout, adding patches of colour, adding shapes, adding bits of collage, and then just keep going back and back and back to the pages and just start building it up. So I've gone back to that and I'm quite enjoying that. Don't know where it's going to lead, but that's quite fun. No sense of really where it's going to go, but I'm enjoying that and also struggling a little bit with the idea of, yeah, well, it's just bits of colour and random marks on a page.
Yeah, isn't it funny how we do that, though? It's like it's got to be something, and it will be. It's coming for a reason. It's just, yeah, it's all part of it, isn't it? It doesn't have to be anything. It just has to be what's coming out of you, what's trying to get out at the moment. That's what I think it is.
Yeah, and there were two things. So yesterday, somebody shared another artist's paintings on Instagram and I commented and I said, I love this one too, but isn't it funny? But I look at it and I know that if I'd done that, I'd wonder if it was enough. Mm. Like if it's saying enough, if it has enough reason for being there. But yet I look at it and my feeling is just, oh, I love that. And then there was something else that I saw this morning and I could see in the background of when they were talking, there was just this painting and I just had this instinctive reaction of like, oh yeah, forget what you're talking about, but oh, I want to go and have a look at that. I want that. Mm. And then I was looking at it and I was thinking, but there is nothing to it really. It's just texture and a line coming through it. And yet it has that pull. And because you've done it, not me, I can appreciate it. So there's something in there about being able to appreciate our own work. And I don't know if you ever get over that. Don't know if you ever want to get over that, really. Maybe that's why it's so important for me to be able to show your work to other people.
Yeah. I know I often see, what that reminds me of is I'll often see something where I love it, but the paint application is really rough and ready, or the brush strokes are really, and I think, oh, I love that. And then I think, I would have tidied that up. Mm. But actually, I love it the way it is. I would have thought, oh, that just looks like someone who hasn't bothered. You know, you need to, I need to tidy that up. Whereas actually, yeah, I love it in other people's stuff. So it is a good point. And I do love simple things, but they always work as paintings, the things we love. Never look and you think, oh, I love that, but it's terrible colour. I love that, but it's terrible design, do you? It's always working in those ways.
It's just that instinctive pull or not, isn't it? And I know that some of my favourite paintings that I've ever done would massively fall short on probably all sorts of different ways that you might judge them. but I don't care because they're my favourite. So it's just getting to that point. And I think maybe that's what it is in sketchbooks. Just doing a drawing of a thing is just starting to feel a little bit insignificant. So it's almost like I'm working on these pages of the sketchbook, like you might build up a painting. Mm-hmm. Anyway, it's fun. What about you?
Well, I'm going to talk about painting when we get to the main topic, but I have treated myself to a big paint order of really nice paints, and I've been playing with those. So particularly trying out some fluid paints, which I've had a couple of tubes of, not tubes, they come in bottles, but a couple of them in the past,
yeah,
but not any great number. So I've had a few of these colours before, but not as many. I've actually chosen my favourite colours, but in fluid paint. And now I've just been trying them out for glazing, which has been really interesting because I normally just water down my normal paint for glazing. And so the colours are much richer when I'm using these. And next I'm going to go on to, I've got my jelly plate out and I'm going to have another go with that, because the last time I used that, I was using normal paint and trying to make it work, and it was all right. But
did you have normal paint and retarder?
No, I just had normal paint, and so
too dry.
Yeah, so I got some things, but it was not as good as I know it can be. So I'm excited to have a go with that and start making some collage papers for the work that I'm doing now. But it was funny. I got all the paints in my basket, and they were golden paints. So they're expensive. And it was really hard to press that button to say, okay, buy them. Even though I have the money and it's a business expense. So there shouldn't, I was just interested noticing that I was like, say a business course, I would spend that money without worrying about it. Because I would think, well, that'll pay for itself. You know, that's an investment. Whereas this, I've still got this little thing that says that's a luxury, that's a treat. And of course it's not, because it's going into work that's going to sell, and it is an investment, but still, just thought it was interesting to notice. But anyway, I'm enjoying them. And
I think it's something to do with the fact that paints are, they're consumable. Whereas buying the panels or buying the canvas is a thing, you feel like you're buying a thing. Whereas paints, I don't know about you, but you have the sense that you spend a lot of money and they kind of go. But equally, I know that I still have paints, and I remember at the time spending, I think it was the first time I'd spent over £200 on paints, and thinking, that's so much money. And it is a lot of money, but some of those paints I still have. So sometimes some of them last a long time. If they're colours that you don't use a lot of, don't use very frequently, that there's something to do with the fact that you can't tell how quickly or how long it's going to last that makes it hard to spend on. But I really, when we bought, we just bought our son recently, a moped scooter. And so the things that you had, like we had to buy a helmet, £250, you have to buy a jacket, £100, you've got to have shoes that cover your ankles. Like, and all of this stuff adds up. And it almost feels like there's no choice about it having made that decision. Whereas with paints, it almost feels like, oh, that's just an extra. And it's kind of not. It's sort of a secure.
it's an important tool of the trade.
Rather important. I'm just wondering, next time though, I tend to order too many different colours, I think.
Yeah.
And but I'm wondering,
is there any such thing as too many different colours?
Well, I could tell, if you look at my shoeboxes of paint tubes, I'm looking at them, and half of me is thinking I need to do another paint order, and half of me is looking at them thinking you have enough paint there to last you quite a long time. I don't know whether to just squeeze out all the reds into a big bucket that says red. Just have a giant huge squirty tube and just mix all my own randomly, not know what's in them. I don't know, consolidate somehow.
So yes, thank you everybody for the kind messages. People were worried about me after last week, said I sounded down, and I really wasn't all that down. I just thought it was interesting, and it would be a good topic to talk about because I know it's something everybody goes through. and it would give Alice a chance to laugh at me and say, ha ha, you see. But I was feeling lost, and what I found really interesting, so I'll start if you don't mind, because I've been thinking about this. I found it really interesting that there were a couple of things you said to me in that podcast, which I re-listened to it so that I would get any advice you were giving or any insights you had properly by listening to it again. And at one point you said, whatever is going on, it will be a breakthrough. And I know that's true, because always the times when I'm most down is when something good happens after. But you also said this, you also said almost in passing that I think you might be holding on too tight to your Ted Hughes idea. And that was like major light bulb, because that's exactly what I teach in my course. It's a, you know, what the main premise of that course is, that the more thinky and you get, and the more focused on a result, the more you try and produce something, the less likely it's actually going to happen. And that the more lightly you hold on to it, the more likely it's going to happen. And what had I done? I'd gone all tight and, you know, it's got to look like this. And I don't even know that I had an idea of what I wanted to look like, but I was definitely holding on tightly to achieving a result, which had taken me off track. And the accidental incident that happened with the sanding turned out to be the revelation that along with what you said, and I've written in the notes here that it took five people to bash me on the head and tell me. It took you. It took the guy who helped me sand the painting I talked about last week. It took my husband, Phil. And then it took two other artists that I was talking to and comments they made. And all put together, it was like the universe was going, hello, bash you on the head again one more time. And I know some people don't believe in the universe, but you know what I mean? Just it was like it was there and I couldn't see it. And the realize, so it caused this huge breakthrough for me. It all came together where I realized there's something really here. No, I do not want to just sand back paintings and then say that's done, unless in the very random case where it actually happened to be perfect, but that's not going to happen. But the idea of working with a sanded surface, I kind of do that anyway. I often sand my paintings and then I rework most of them and just keep bits of the texture. But I thought the idea of using the texture would be interesting, and reworking the colors and changing, orchestrating things a bit more, and perhaps, you know, taking out some texture where I don't want it, adding some in where I do, but basically sanding back a painting and then working with what I'm given to develop it and create something out of it felt really exciting. So I shared that idea in my weekly newsletter, and I shared the painting that I had, the sanded painting, which I'd subsequently worked on for 3 days solid and changed in subtle ways so that I was happy with it and really happy with it. And I shared that with people, and I got these messages back, which were, again, helpful, helping me think. So two people wrote to me and said, this is a palimpsest, which I had to look up.
Good word.
And it's a really good word. And what a palimpsest is a manuscript or piece of writing material on which later writing has been superimposed on effaced earlier writing, or a second definition, something reused or altered but still bearing visible traces of its earlier form. I have so much that I love about that in life in general. That's what I'm interested in. And then Peter wrote to me on Facebook and said he's interested in landscape, and in landscape study there's this term time depth, which is the way something reflects the time that has happened. So the way you can see Iron Age field patterns in the current landscape, or so on. So not so much the geology, but the people impact, the human impact of time on the landscape. And all of this was kind of going, it still ties in with my Ted Hughes idea, because his poetry is about, the poetry I like, the ones I'm drawn to, are about the way humans impose themselves on the landscape, build a mill, build a mill town, then the mill closes, then the weeds take over, the birds come back, the nature will always beat humans. And so the landscape layers in that way. And I don't know where it will go, but I know that I'm excited and I feel really fired up, and I've just bought about tons of power tools.
You can never go wrong with power tools. Never, ever.
So that's a long introduction to say, I thought this would be an interesting topic, because the second part of what happens is, so I sanded back that painting. It looked great. I made it look better. I love it. That's that.
I think that's an important part before we go on, because this feeling about the sanding and you do it, but it's not quite satisfying. Because I've been thinking a lot about this week, because it doesn't, at that point, it's too random. It doesn't have enough of you in it. You've got to impose something of you on it again that makes it your painting. And it was like, there was the photograph that you shared on Instagram, and I messaged you and said, oh, this looks a lot more exciting, and you went, yay, everything's feeling good again. And what it made me think of, because it was that kind of purpley gray feeling in that, mm-hmm. almost impossible texture. And it's like when you take a photograph of the lichen on stone walls and you look at it and you think, how could you possibly recreate that in a way that is as beautiful as it is? You know, you either do a hyper photorealistic painting, or you're just not going to. You're going to do this kind of awkward summary of it. Whereas what you're doing now, it's almost like previously, it's kind of the struggle that I'm having. You're on the outside of the landscape, looking in at it, trying to get this idea of what it feels like to be in it. And now what's happening in the painting is, it is it.
Yeah.
You're almost like really recreating it, but in its own form, rather than trying to do a version of what already exists in the landscape. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
It is a big jump. I think it's tough.
It's a huge jump. But what it made me realize is, okay, so on that particular instance, the sanded back painting looked really good to begin with and needed some editing, but was really good. Then what happens is you sand back a couple of others, because boy, have I got a lot of paintings lying around that can be sanded back. So I sanded back some others and, oh, there's nothing there, you know. So then I started to think, this is where it gets exciting to me, because then I started to think, right, so how could I make that happen again? Like, how can I work with this idea and knowing that I'll fail over and over again while I'm trying it? But if I choose a color palette and I build up layers and I find different ways to do that, so, and I take pictures as I go along and see if I can track what I'm doing, will it work if I plan the color palettes and the layers? Will it work best if I paint intuitively three or four layers and then sand back? I don't know. And will it work best if I use this tool or that tool? And how can I get the kind of textures and feeling that I want? Mm. It gives me this whole kind of investigation to go off on, which is totally mine and not, when I look at the other paintings I was working on for the Ted Hughes, I feel like, yeah, you know, they're nice. The funny thing is, I feel like that one that I sanded and finished, this is what told me it was a breakthrough. I felt like I'm not selling that for the same price I normally sell things for. Mm. That's worth more. Mm. And if somebody doesn't want to pay more, I'll keep that because that's worth more. That was exciting to me, because that's when I know that's mine. And it's got an idea behind it. It's got a process behind it. It's got, or they will have if they work.
Yeah. Now you've just got to do it again and again and again.
Yeah. But what's exciting, and also I wanted to talk about this because there was a little bit of me that the second painting I sanded back which I don't think had as many layers on it, but I can't remember what's got what on it, so that's the problem, was disappointing. It was like, it was just a big mess. There was nothing there to work with. And I thought, oh, this is not going to, like, you know, every time I do this, I'm not going
to... Damn it, I haven't cracked the golden ticket. That's a mixed metaphor, isn't it? Gold ticket, golden eggs, whatever the solution is. Yeah.
But I think we get that feeling when we've had something exciting happen. It's like if you make a painting very spontaneously and then you want to reproduce it and you can't. Mm-mm. It's kind of, there could be a point. And also the sanding is physically quite tiring and the tools I'm using now are quite tiring.
Does it make your hands vibrate?
Yeah, and it makes my shoulders hurt. And I've got to wear this big mask thing. I look like the fly, or it's just really, so you could go, oh, this is just, yeah, it was a good idea, but it's not going to work because this is going to be too much time and trouble, and I'm just going to have to try lots of things and none of them are going to work at first. And I picture that there'll be failure, little success. Ooh, follow that a bit. Failure, little success, follow that. And I think it's very easy to get discouraged at that point. And I think it's important not to.
Yeah. So it's because whenever we do something like that for the first time, and you do get that adrenaline, zingy serotonin buzz, don't you? Where you go, ooh-ah.
Yeah.
And it's funny because we go through these cycles where you want to be able to reproduce it somehow. And yet as soon as you do, as soon as you get to the stage where you can reproduce it reliably, starts to become boring again.
Yeah.
But you've got to go through it. And I think that point where the first time it happens and you're excited and you think you're onto something, and then you try it again and it perhaps doesn't work in quite the same way, you think, well, maybe that was just random. Was it just good luck? There was no skill from me involved in that. That was just, you know, oh, damn. But I think as long as you've got this sense that you're talking about of, oh, I could try this, and oh, I could try this, and I could try doing that, and really building it up, and does it work better if I use colors that are contextual with each other or harmonize, or does it work better if I use really contrasting layers over each other, or is that just going to create zebra effect when I sand it, or whatever it is. And at the moment, you don't know what the answer is to that, but just the thought of it is enough to propel you to keep going. I think that's the thing. It's that whatever's going to propel you to keep going.
Yeah.
And you have to work until that point. And then when you work to that point, then you know you're going to keep going with, as you say, the realization that there's still going to be these ups and downs of it.
Yeah. And I think what's been interesting is I mentioned it in my newsletter, and I got a ton of emails of people asking me what kind of sander do you use, and can I sand canvas, and can I sand oil paints, and all sorts of questions. And there's nothing wrong, obviously, with being inspired by seeing someone else try something and then you go try it. But I think the ideas that you do have that momentum with, that you're saying, that desire to keep pushing, are the ones that relate and tie into something of you and who you are already and what you already enjoy.
Yeah.
So I already know that the times I've been happiest in the past working is when I get my sander out. I already know that I love that feeling. I love revealing layers. And I know, as you say, it matches to the textures of the landscape that I love. It's why I stand in front of old stone castles looking at the rock. And it's why I'm interested in reading the things I'm interested in. I'm interested in layers of time, history, how things overlay over each other.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure yet whether it'll be entirely landscape, because I'm interested in it personally. So the painting I sanded back, I'd done three or four layers on it recently, not being happy with any of them, but I'd written things into them. They weren't landscape based. It was, the layers were all very abstract, and I'd written my own feelings into it and then covered them over, and then written more feelings and covered them over. And I'd thought to myself, this is like me in life. This is what I do. If I ever come out and actually say something strong and bold and set a boundary, or, and then I hurt somebody, then I go, oh, I didn't, you know, sorry, I didn't really mean it like that. We, you know, there's another, we can sort it out. Or, and then I cover it over again. So the act of painting was making me realize is very much what I do in life too.
Yeah.
And that's the one that ended up, it all got sanded away. So anything I'd written on there is long gone now. So I could also see these going, being more personal, and not about landscape. And I just think I have to be all right with whatever it's going to be.
Yeah.
Think I could easily take what you're saying now and start thinking, ooh, stone walls, lichen textures, landscape textures. And then I could start getting,
it's too specific though,
inky yeah, again, yeah. couldn't I?
Yeah.
Whereas that might end up being what it is, but I can see these two strands to it. And and maybe it could be both. I don't know. Maybe my connection to this place is a personal connection. So maybe it ends up being both.
So this is interesting, isn't it? So it's less about having a breakthrough and then what comes up the other side, as opposed to where we try to create boundaries for ourselves that we have to feel that we have to exist in. And again, I've been thinking about this week while I've not been doing anything and just been thinking about, is there a way that you can, you know, what is it with the kind of paintings? And again, this is because I'm away from the studio and I'm not doing it. What is it about paintings that I look at in others and really admire? And when I feel that when I'm painting, like I've got one on the studio wall at the moment that I love doing, it feels like nothing I've done before. And I can't tell at the moment yet whether it's done or the beginning or just a starting point of something. But I think we all start because of the way we're taught at school, and because I think you do need that observational grounding that helps you learn all the different elements of art, which I think is really helpful to know. But I think we start with this sense of drawing an object, drawing a thing. And you certainly, I don't think you can make meaningful, rich, contextual art without having some degree of life experience, travel, ups and downs, emotion, all of those kind of things. I think it's very hard to put that all into an abstract painting that feels like it has enough to it when you're 17.
Mm-hmm.
So it's almost like, do we all just have to go through this process of drawing, learning, studying, and then moving away from that towards another way of working, with which has different source material, different reason? And again, and I came to the exact same conclusion as you. You're just overthinking this and trying to put things into categories. It just is what it is. You're just going to be interested in different stages of doing things with your work at different time.
Yeah. I thought about the boundaries we put on ourselves. I was thinking about one thing I've always thought is I'd love to make art that's as personal as Tracy Emin makes. I'm not putting myself in Tracy Emin's category, but I admire how personal she is. I admire that she is so open, and because in the personal is the universal. So when someone shares their very, very personal life experience, we can resonate with it, or at least part of it, because we've had similar experience. And I've always put the boundary on myself, yeah, but you could never do that because of what I've just said, because I would not the kind of person who would ever like just go, here's everything, no filters, here's me. But then I had this massive revelation the other day walking the dog that yeah, because you haven't got the same personality.
No,
your very personal honest art is different from somebody who would blurt everything out to anybody and has no and doesn't care if it hurts other people, and you know, just is going to be honest and do their art no matter what. I'm not that person, but that, so my honest art is my honest art, which might be these covered up history laden textured surfaces, which I know what's in there but nobody else does.
I think it's helpful to recognize that though, so to recognize what it is that you admire in her work. So the kind of outspokenness, the fact that she seems fearless in what she displays, mm-hmm. as opposed to, for example, a painter who is meticulously, beautifully, skillfully accurate. And I think it goes back to that feeling thing. We can admire and appreciate both different things, but perhaps some of them we look at and we go, oh, I wish I had a bit of that.
Yeah.
I just want a bit of that. And I just think those things can be really useful, that just kind of keep nudging us in the right direction.
I think that's true. So what are we saying about breakthroughs? Because this is like 1 week in, and it's very, I should say, this could be a cul-de-sac. Like, we've talked about cul-de-sacs.
It's going to be a thing now, the cul-de-sac, isn't
it? This could be a cul-de-sac, but I don't think it is, because I feel so, so differently about that painting than about any of my others. So I really do feel it's a breakthrough. But I think there's a danger with breakthroughs of burnout as well. I wonder if there is, of like getting too excited, like a shooting star burning out because you've just...
Well, because you then set your expectations for yourself too high?
Yeah, maybe. I don't even know why I think that, to be honest, because it's too soon to know I would feel that. But I just feel like there's a sense that you might get so excited and go rush headlong in. And then get disappointed if it's not quick enough. But I think in this instance, that wouldn't happen. And this is what I was trying to say about people doing something, it's got to be true to you. I think in this instance, it wouldn't happen because I so much enjoyed the feel of a sander. But if you tried to do something and it's not really you, then I could see it, you might fizzle out. And that's what I was probably doing before with the other paintings.
Yeah.
I was trying to do it in a way that wasn't, I thought it was authentic, but I don't think it was. And it didn't.
I just think we're just always working on shifting sands. Always. Yeah. Always, always, always.
That should be the title, Shifting Sands.
Should it? We're just nothing is ever standing still, and we don't want it to. Like, We want things to be always shifting and changing, and it's the same thing here, isn't it? You know, when we're in that phase where we think things are a bit static, we want this somehow dramatic transformation. And when you have those breakthroughs or those moments where you think, oh, I've really got something here, it's fantastic, some of it is just accepting that it's still not going to be like that all the time. It's the same thing. Basically, all we need to do is just turn up and paint and have a lobotomy on the way in through the door.
I think I need the lobotomy to remove my lack of patience, because that's one thing that struck me. The only thing about this process that will be different for me is I'll need to be patient. If I want to layer different palettes over one another, for example, you really need to leave acrylic. I've already learned that it needs to be 3 or 4 days if it's thick,
really dry,
to be really dry to get the effects you want. So
otherwise it just peels, doesn't it, with the sand?
Yeah,
it doesn't work.
Yeah, so each of those layers, and I'm also so I need patience to let them all dry properly, and that will be a learning for me, because I'll want to get the sander out. But also I'm learning lots of things about how paint works, and I'm going to need to investigate further, because I've got some older paintings where they do just peel. And they're very, very dry. And I don't know why. I don't know why, at what point I did something, perhaps painted over paint that wasn't thoroughly dry. I don't know. But what is happening is you can peel off big chunks. Mm. They were never sealed or anything, but they were just left. And I don't know why that. I think it's got something to do with painting over collage material.
Over really shiny papers or something.
Yeah, maybe, I don't know. So that's something I'm learning too. Like, on one painting, that's not happening, and on another one it is. So there's a lot to learn about how the paint works in order to make this work properly.
Yeah. So you're learning patience, and this is going to make you laugh, because you say that I'm the one that always plans and thinks. I'm learning that I think I want to do more less diving in and just painting with whatever colour I happen to randomly pick up, and more thinking consciously before I begin about which colours I want to include, just because I think it would make the process, it would just streamline things a little bit, and I wouldn't end up with quite such a cacophony of different colours and things going on at different times. I don't know.
See,
I'm hoping that that's what this sketchbook is going to do. I'm going to have all these multiple built-up pages. But it's a little...
Do you not normally not have... Because I normally have quite a limited palette. You don't have that normally.
No, I think I'm naturally drawn towards certain colours.
Yeah.
And I don't think that goes away. But I also know that some of my favourite ones have been ones where I've really broken out from that. So I certainly don't want to get too pre-planned or...
Yeah.
I've never pre-mixed batches of colours in advance. Never.
No, I never have.
But I'm wondering if that would actually be helpful, not from the point... Just helpful because it would make the process of painting quicker and more fun. I think if I had that available, and what I just love that being able to just grab a color and go in a sketchbook. So I love working with like pencils or oil sticks or something in a sketchbook, because you don't have to mix it first. You just pick the color that's right and it's done.
Yeah.
Whereas with paint, I tend to buy all the different versions of primaries and mix as I go, which can slow me down. It gives some fantastic variations, obviously, but it can really slow me down.
I tend to do that too. And I find that my palettes, like I use two big trays as palettes, but two big trays is still not enough for the quantity of paint that you need when you're working on larger things. And if you mixed and pre-mixed in tubs like that, you'd have...
Yeah, well, what I've started doing recently is I've started having four, you know, when you get Chinese takeaways, you get those flat plasticky trays, which I use a lot. I use for packing materials when I'm putting them in a rucksack. I use for all sorts of things. So I might have four of those on the go with different colors-ish in them, which I might mix at the beginning of a session, but at the end of the session I'll just put the lid on and I'll just re-add to it next time. Then I have a tub of off-white open, and then I have my tray laid out next to it. So I might have a really strong dark going, like I think last time I had a really strong dark, a pink, a yellow and a mid blue, and then I have a tray with additional colors in. So I've got a bit of a quantity of paint, but I've also got other colours I can mix with it. So again, it's constantly shifting a bit. Mm-hmm. And that's working quite well as a happy medium.
Yeah.
Between feeling like I'm not always having to stop and keep mixing.
Yeah.
But it's not just the same colour going on each time, because I know I'd just bore myself if I did that.
I tell you what I discovered. Quick final tip. Tomato ketchup bottles.
Yeah.
Big tomato ketchup, the one that you can
that
are upside down. They are brilliant. I mixed a load of off-white and put it in one of those. And because we've got a wide top, it's not so hard to get the paint in as it is with some other bottles.
Yeah.
And they sit upside down, so it's ready to go. And I just put a load of fluid medium in, some heavy bodied paint, mixed up the off-white, and I had it for ages. But of course, as with always with me, the top all clogged up again, because every kind of tub I have like that.
Yeah,
top.
I know.
But I thought, oh, I might get a load. I wonder if you can buy tomato ketchup bottles without tomato ketchup in somewhere, like mass order, and then mix up a load in there.
You just need to put a little thing through everybody in your village and say, I'm collecting tomato ketchup bottles, please. Yeah, I just have big open pots, big, really weird, big, wide jarred plastic tubs there.
Right.
I can just about get my hand span across the lid. They're those bowl B-O-L salad pots,
right.
And I have one of those with an off-white in, and I just dip my paintbrush into it, so what starts off as white has various streaks of other things in,
yeah,
which I quite like the fact. And then I guess at some point it'll get too messy and gray, and then I'll just start another one. So but I quite like that, because it's just, you can just glob in and get it out as much as you want.
Well, we do have something. We have a listener question.
Yes.
So shall we go on to that? And
yeah.
This means we won't be able to waffle because we're actually answering someone's question. So Nicole McPherson, thank you for this question, Nicole. She emailed and she asked, is it okay for an art teacher to commandeer your work? And she explains what she meant. She's been to quite a few workshops and she's come away feeling completely deflated because the teacher has taken over my work. Rather than explaining what or how to do, they show me on my work, and in the process it becomes theirs and I feel useless. Just because you're an artist, it doesn't necessarily mean you're a great teacher. So Nicole's question is it okay for a teacher to do that?
No. No, I remember this feeling, not so much at school. I don't think teachers do it at school so much because they have too many people to do it to. But in life drawing classes where somebody would come over and draw, and I just remember that bodily feeling of you actually feel yourself tensing. It's like, don't touch my work, don't touch my work, don't touch my work. You know, you could really, I don't care if you're making it better. It's like, it's my work, it's my drawing, it's my mistakes to correct. I want to do it.
Yeah.
And actually, I was reading this and I was thinking, this is some really good parenting advice in here that I could probably learn from too. Yeah. We had a thing this week where Paul was doing something, and he was doing something for one of the children because he just thought it would be easier just to do it and get it resolved. And I said, but then they're not going to learn. If you just do it without telling them, they're not going to learn what it takes to do X, Y, and Z. You have to say, this is the parameters, this is the outcome, why don't you try this, or make sure that you have this. He's like, oh, but that takes so long. It's like, yeah, but that's how they're going to learn. Now, yeah. I don't get it perfect all the time. And I'm sure my kids would say, this is a joke coming from you because you're always trying to take over. But I don't feel I am trying to take over. I'm trying to feel that I'm trying to show them what the outcome would be. So in terms of teaching, I think what you want from a teacher is somebody, if you're not understanding, or if you don't have the ability to do it yet, it's one of two things, isn't it? Either you don't understand it properly, or you just don't have the practice yet.
Yeah.
So if you don't understand it properly, they need to talk to you about it. They need to explain. They need to ask you questions and say, so life drawing class is the easiest thing. So rather than taking your charcoal off you and redrawing the leg in a different way, they need to say, well, look, try measuring, or have a look at the distance between. Can you see how his knee is actually ending up below his elbow, and check the spacing between the knee and the other side of his, where his legs end, and check them against the width of his shoulders. Then you know what you're looking for the next time you do a drawing. If somebody just corrects your drawing as it is, you haven't learned anything.
Yeah,
it drives me mad. Sorry.
It is a great question. I totally don't think someone can commandeer your work and should never come and draw on it without asking. But I think it's okay if they ask. So I've been in workshops. I went to Life Drawing and I used to say, Helen, can you just have a look? Because I hate measuring. And if I really couldn't get it by looking, if I really couldn't just, I'd say, can you just put where you think the foot is? And so she would come and she'd put where she thought it was, and that would help me just see what I was not seeing. But that's at my invitation, so I'm okay with that. And David Tress, when I went in his workshop, did paint on people's paintings, but he asked first. So he said, do you want me to tell you, or do you want me to show you? And then people would either say, no, show me.
Nice.
And Jeanette, who we both know, Jeanette Phillips, she had this very delicate, beautiful painting, and she said, no, do it on my painting. And it was a big painting that she'd been working on for ages, and she was painting these buttercup fields in a kind of abstract way, and he just came in, loaded up a big brush full of yellow paint, and did a giant brush stroke across the front of her painting. She said, go ahead. And it looked stunning. It was like the difference between her delicate work and his giant bold brushstroke. she went, oh, that's finished. And she framed it and it's in a gallery now somewhere. She just told me that she's just taken it to a gallery. But she can't say, I said you should say by Jeanette Phillips and David Tress. But I liked that he asked, because some people yes. do like you to show them.
Yeah, okay, and Jeanette, fair enough.
And Jeanette's a confident enough artist that she's fine with, okay, do it on my painting and I'll do another one. But I totally feel for Nicole, because somebody just taking and doing it without asking you is assuming, like she says, it's making you feel useless. It's making you feel like there's not even any point in explaining this to you. I might as well just do it for you, which is not teaching, is it?
So. No. And it goes back to what we were talking about a little bit before, really, about the process of time and things developing over time. And I think it shows that there is, we all have an impatience to get where we want to get to. And I think perhaps that some of it can be very, well, all of it, I suspect, is very well-intentioned on the part of the teacher. I don't think anybody spends their time teaching because they don't want to help you, and I think that all they're trying to do is help you to get from A to B a little bit quicker, because it feels good. Like when we leave a class and we've created a work that we love or we enjoy or we feel proud of, or you know, we feel we did well in it, it feels good. And you know, when you come out of a class and you think, oh, I just didn't get that was exhausting, that's hard work. But this, it's kind of it's just bouncing back a little bit the wrong way when it's gone too far and becomes theirs. So some of this is how you get over the sense that it feels theirs. Say it's happened. Part of it, I think, is just telling yourself, well, I'm here to learn. This is part of the learning process. This is part of the practice. It doesn't matter if they've drawn on that. I can do another one anytime.
Yeah, and I think that's a really good point, because Nicole says it becomes theirs and I feel useless.
Yeah.
And nobody can make you feel useless. You're making yourself feel useless. They just drew on your picture. It's like they just did something which perhaps was ill-advised, but it doesn't make you useless. So you have to, instead of making that mean something about you and spoiling the workshop experience, it means something about them. It means they've maybe not got the best teaching technique, but it doesn't mean that you're useless and you can't take that feeling away, because then you just spoiled the whole thing.
And also the other thing that I might say is, so if it's become theirs, you do what you need to do to take it back to make it yours again, because part of this depends where it stops. So if you've been working on something, and again, I don't know, it's not clear from this whether this is an evening or a day or over a week workshop or something, but I can totally understand that, say you're at an evening workshop and you've spent 2 hours doing a measured, careful drawing or working on a painting, and teacher comes along and does something on it in the last 15 minutes. You don't have the time to go back and do it again, to reclaim it again, and it feels like they've undone all the work that you've done. But one thing I do know is all of that time that you put in before that point is all valid time, because all of that time you are learning about what you're looking at, the marks you're making, how you're mixing, all of those things. And they've all gone into that piece of work, and you can add or change from that at any point. And sometimes when somebody else has come in and put a different angle on it, like perhaps you're saying with David Tress and Jeanette's work, that can be a new spark that just gives you momentum to go back in and maybe flip it back your direction a little bit. So some of it is looking at what they did to it. Did it help? In which case, stop grumbling and learn from it. Because that's what you're there for. I think it can be very useful as well, because I think it does get rid of that preciousness that we can have over work. That, I mean, I said at the beginning, oh, don't touch my painting. If we feel like that about it, though, like if I do a mark on it and it's going to ruin it, or if you do a mark on it and it's going to ruin it, then it just ends up getting more and more and more and more precious. So I think actually if somebody has come in and they've done something and destroyed it, changed it, made it theirs, made it better, whatever, you've already taken it off into a new realm, and then it's good to bring it back again. It's a good practice to come back from, I think, is what I'm trying to say.
And I also, something else that struck me, when I'm teaching my course, I think for some people, because I teach entirely find your own way, I'm going to give you guideposts, but I'm not going to tell you what to do. I'm not even going to demo. I'm just, you're going to do it yourself. There are some people who find that difficult, and they want you to tell them what to do, and they want you to show them. And these teachers, Nicole's obviously not that kind of person, but some of the people in the class will be. They'll be the people who do want to be shown. Just do it for me so I can see it. Like me with my life drawing teacher. Just show me where the foot should be. So when she draws the foot in, I suddenly see what I'm doing wrong. I don't need her to go into a big explanation. It's like, oh, I got what I did wrong. I see where you're seeing it different than me. So there are people and there are situations where it's probably worked for that teacher. So I don't think it necessarily even means they're a bad teacher. There are different teachers for different style, for different people. And the way one person teaches is brilliant for Nicole, and the way a different person teaches isn't. But the person next to her in the workshop might have gone home and said, oh, it was fantastic. And she even drew on my picture to show me what I was doing wrong. You know, it doesn't, we're not all brave enough to go out on our own doing everything. Some of us want someone to point the way a bit.
Yeah, and I think we've mentioned this before, haven't we, that actually lots of workshops that you go to, if it's a week away or something like that, there are always going to be elements of it that you like and that really speak to you, and elements of it that you think, not so fast about that. So as long as you're getting something from the time, I think that's a good part.
So I think we started off saying one thing and now we might have changed our minds and said another, speaking of rambling. But anyway, I hope it was helpful. So let's close with what's inspired or what have we enjoyed this week. We keep changing what this segment is, but I'm smiling because I see in the notes what yours is, and I love this. So
Tell us what. So mine was watching the film yesterday. So I really recommend it. Apart from anything else, everything that we seem to have watched on television recently has been, I don't know, thoroughly dislikable, horrible people, or just, I don't know. And sometimes I don't mind that. This was the complete opposite. This was total feel good. So the film is Yesterday, and the premise of the film is there's a worldwide power cut. Like it happens. It's really believable. The entire film is really believable. And this guy gets knocked off his bike. And when he wakes up, he's a musician, and he gets, I'm not going to go into all the details, but basically he's the only person in the world who knows the Beatles songs. So if he mentions them, if he sings them, nobody's ever heard of them. If he Googles them, what he ends up Googling, it's really funny. And there are various little points in the film where he Googles other things that consequently don't exist as a result. It's brilliant. So it's just a really good feel good film. It's funny. Some of the script writing early on is really laugh out loud funny, sharp. Richard Curtis wrote the screenplay, which means that it has a really appallingly badly romantic ending. Honestly,
I love those endings. I love Richard Curtis.
Awful. But the actor is Himesh Patel, and he plays the character, and he does all his own singing, and he has a really lovely voice. And it was just lovely to listen to all those Beatles songs again. And can you imagine a world without Beatles songs?
I know. So, it's funny to think. I just found the whole premise really funny. And you think, God, imagine if, like, well, it wouldn't work in painting. So if nobody remembered Van Gogh, you still couldn't create his paintings. But it worked in music, because if nobody remembers the Beatles, then you're the only one who does, then you can easily play them again.
Yeah. But yeah, quite funny to think all of those things, like, well, actually, if you did just turn up now singing Beatles songs, would they be recognised in quite the same way? Or were, I mean, that was the only bit. Yeah. Were they really only of their era? And would they be written off now as, you know, some crazy things that don't quite work? Like, which artist, like, if you turned up now painting like Salvador Dali, would you make it? Would you get recognised? Who knows?
Well, so the other quite fun. I thought about that was, if you turned up as the Beatles singing the Beatles songs, but you're one guy, you're not four guys with charm and charisma and a connection between them and all of that.
Yeah.
Would it work? You know, there's an other side of it too.
Don't overthink it though, Alison Louise. Don't overthink it. If you just want to sit down in an evening, watch a really good film, and enjoy it. If you haven't watched it yet, you're in for a treat. And we've also just started watching Parasite, South Korean film, Parasite.
Oh, I want to see that. And I've got it to watch and I haven't.
Halfway through with subtitles, so Paul gave up last night, so I'll report back on that next
week. So my inspiration this week is books, and I've got really out of reading. I'm a person who, by the time I was six, I'd read all the books in the junior class library, you know, the first class at school, and I read as a kid voraciously, and the older I've got, the less attention span I've got for reading. It's really quite sad. But we have bookshelves in our living room full of books that we brought back when we moved back. We got rid of almost all our possessions. We got rid of thousands of books. But we went through and kind of curated the books that mean something to us and kept just those. And then we ended up having to build bookshelves to put them on because there weren't any in the house. And I kept thinking, why are we keeping these books? I read everything on an iPad anyway. But in the last few weeks, for some reason, I went back to the bookshelves. Was bored one day and I needed something to do. I pulled a book off the shelf and started reading it, an old book that I brought home. It was a Penelope Lively book, and she was my favorite novelist when I was, I guess, in college and just after, like, 80s, 90s. And I started reading it, and it so perfectly ties into this idea of palimpsests and time depth, because Penelope Lively's novels are normally about the way that history layers over, and somebody's life, like Moon Tiger is one of my favorites, is a woman dying and looking back over her life. And it's like she's seeing the different versions of herself. There's the 20-year-old version. Now I'm looking at the 40-year-old version. And the novel I picked off the shelf is called Spiderweb. And it's about a woman who retires. She's what do you call it? An anthropologist. She studies societies around the world. She retires to a tiny village. Predictably, it's not as idyllic as tiny villages look like from the outside. It's got all sorts going on. But while the story is kind of flimsy, really, the plot, but she's reliving her past life now that she's retired. She keeps going back to older versions of herself. And the way she describes and writes about that process of aging and then memory is really beautiful. So I've gone through the bookshelves and dug out all of the ones of hers that I have. Turns out I'm missing some, so I need to buy more, and I'm going to work my way through them. And as I was going through the bookshelves, it turns out you can have an awful lot of books of Ted Hughes's poetry. I seem to have more books of his poetry than he wrote, because I think I've got a lot of collected works. So it definitely is a true interest. I discovered that. But anyway, yes, Penelope Lively. If anybody hasn't ever heard of her, I do recommend her novels. She won the Booker Prize for Moon Tiger. But while they're literary, they're also readable and enjoyable. And I find literary novels a bit too much at my age now. I just don't have the attention span for them.
Yeah, the one that I'm reading has taken me a little bit of time to get into. It's by Sarah Hall. It's called How to Paint a Dead Man, and again, it's a multi-layered different viewpoint book. Took me a while to get into, but I'm really enjoying it.
I know
it's what is part of my list about books about paintings or painters. Got a question for you though. Oh, and there's somebody else to recommend if you haven't read already. Anita Shreve writes some interesting books, and some of them, I can't remember which titles, but they, because of this idea about things based around time, so rather it's the same person, it's a place, so it's a particular house. So each book, although it's a totally different standalone novel about totally different people, features the house over time. Oh, the one to start with is the pilot's wife. So the house reappears and you're trying to work out if it's before or after.
Okay.
So that's quite a good one to read. Okay. Question though, with so many good books in the world, why go back to ones you've read rather than find new ones?
Well, partly this is all
I struggle with.
I have no memory of having read Spiderweb. I'm sure I did.
Oh, really?
No memory of it.
Will you not get through to page 100 and go, oh yeah, I've read this?
Yeah, I mean, I know I've read it because I know I read all of her books at one point, but I had no memory. I didn't know what was going to happen. And something happened towards the end, which was quite dramatic. No memory.
Oh, so really?
Partly getting old is a good thing because I've got books where I've bought this. And that's the other thing we found when we got rid of books. I've got the same book three times, you know. Yeah. I bought it at different times without knowing I already had it.
Yeah.
So all I remember about Moon Tiger is that it's about a woman dying and that you go back over her life. They're so long ago that I read them that I really do, I want the pleasure because I know it was pleasurable, and also I want, because it ties into what I'm doing, I thought it'd be good. I'd feel it was productive use of novel reading time.
Okay. And I think also you appreciate different things when you go back to a book. And I think if they're good books that really withstand rereading, you get something different from them on second reading. Maybe the first time you're more interested in the story, and then the second time you appreciate the language more when you know it a little bit. So, yeah, there is a sense of that. Okay, all right, I'll allow you that.
It's quite funny, this idea of memory. Given that I'm talking about memory and laying things over, I have zero memory. The very best book I ever read, and I know I enjoyed it as the best book I ever read, and I always tell people it's the best book, is called No Night Is Too Long by Barbara Vine. Barbara Vine is actually also Ruth Rendell, who writes mysteries. But as Barbara Vine, she writes more literary novels. No Night Is Too Long is incredible. It's shocking. There's a big shock twist. To this day, I couldn't tell you what it is. If my life depended on it and you said now, what is the big twist and what's the story about? Cannot remember. And I've read that book three or four times in my life. So
it's like when you watch a film and you think, I know this. Oh, God. Yeah, that's it. You think, how could I forget that?
I know. I presume if I picked it up again, I would eventually at some point remember, because I have read that a few times. But that is how bad I am. So I'm doing artwork about memory and history, and I have no memory or history.
That's why. Right. I am typing because I'm thinking you guys are all going to ask about these books again. So they will be in the show notes. So you can find the show notes if you're listening on an app. If you click more info about the podcast, it will be there. Or you can go to louisefletcherart.com or aliceSheridan.com, and we both have a page for the podcast that has all the details about it. So yeah, I can see another book list coming up. But there you go, something to keep you going over the rest of the summer.
That's it for us this week. We've talked a long time, so I'll keep this short and sweet. Have a brilliant creative week, and we will see you next week.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Good, isn't it?
It is. So I think we got a bit off topic, but I still think we covered quite a bit there on breakthroughs.
I always think every week we just waffle and talk nonsense, and then we get these messages and people say it was really good this week. Really? Paul has a wetsuit. He wimps out. He's like, I need a wetsuit. I'm like, there's 120 people on this beach who say otherwise, but you go ahead. Thank you.